If you have a podcast and want to monetize it, stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Greetings and welcome to Hello Pine Knob, the official podcast for the Pine Knob Music Theater in Independence Township, Michigan. I'm your host, Gary Graff, back for a third season of documenting everything that goes on in one of the country's oldest and busiest amphitheaters. The summer season is upon us, and coming up at Pine Knob before our next episode, we have A Boogie with the Hoodie on Friday, June 14th, New Kids on the Block on Tuesday, June 18th, Maroon 5 on Friday, June 21st, Hank Williams Jr. with Marty Stewart and his Fabulous Superlatives on Saturday, June 22nd, James Taylor on Sunday, June 23rd, Santana and Counting Crows on Tuesday, June 25th, and the Dave Matthews Band on Wednesday, June 26th. Before we get to our main story, we wanted to touch on another upcoming show, the return of frequent visitors Styx and Foreigner to Pine Knob on Saturday, June 15th. The two classic bands are out on a Renegades and Jukebox Heroes tour with John Waite, marking the first time in a decade they've hit the road together. We asked Styx's Tommy Shaw for some memories about playing Pine Knob, and he shared this with us.
Pine Knob is just different from everywhere else. You're right there at the foot. They're at the foot of the stage, always. There was one time where the hockey team, they won the Stanley Cup, and it happened right near the end of our show. The place went just crazy. You know, we just finished playing Renegade, and then that news came on, and it was sweet to see them, to see that all happen in one night.
Foreigner's Kelly Hansen also shared his thoughts about Pine Knob, where his band performed just last summer.
Well, one of the biggest rock and roll states there is. And that iconic name, you always remember that when you're on the road. You know, you can play a lot of places that kind of just blur together. And I would be lying if I say I remember every single place we play. But that one's a special rock and roll icon for sure.
Yeah. Are there any things about it, I guess, physically that you feel distinguishes it?
The only thing that's really consistent is that we're always there in the beautiful time of year in the summertime, and it's just a beautiful place. And when you tour most of the year, a lot of the time you're not always in a place that is always green and beautiful, but every time we're there, it's green and beautiful.
Once again, Styx, Foreigner, and John Waite perform Saturday, June 15th at Pine Knob. And now on to our main story. During the mid and late 70s, Andy Freeberg and Daryl Pitt served as Pine Knob's official photographers, spending night after night at the theater chronicling performances by just about every act that played there. Andy studied at the University of Michigan and has had his work published in publications such as Time, Fortune, Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, and Der Spiegel. He was also an official photographer for the Montreux Jazz Festival. Since 2007, he's focused primarily on his own fine art projects, and his work has been exhibited in museums and galleries around the world. Daryl cut his teeth taking photos of Pine Knob and subsequently went on tour with several artists he had met there, including Crosby, Stills and Nash, Diana Ross, Liza Minnelli, Harry Chapin, and Neil Diamond. He was also an official photographer for the Montreux Jazz Festival, worked for Rolling Stone magazine, and has had his images exhibited at museums in Paris, Tokyo, and Zurich. His photos have also been used on album covers for, among others, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Dizzy Gillespie, Chick Corea, Mitch Ryder, and Diane Reeves. Andy and Daryl are special guests on this episode of Hello Pine Knob. So let's start with how you guys became the Pine Knob photographers in the first place. Andy, you want to go first?
Sure. So I was working at the Michigan Daily, student-run newspaper. It was my sophomore year. I had the great luck of becoming a photo editor in my sophomore year because the previous photo editor was a senior. He graduated, went on to New York. And so all of a sudden, I could assign myself anything I wanted to do. And I was a big music fan, jazz fan, rock fan. And I went to every concert I could go to. And it's like, I got a front row seat. I'm taking pictures. The pictures come out in the newspaper the next day. Everybody at Michigan sees it. This guy, Daryl Pitt, calls me up and says, "Hey, listen, I've been seeing all your pictures. You know, come over to my, it was your dorm room or apartment, wherever you were. I got a proposition. I have an idea. I want to do a project with you this summer." And that was
wait. You got to stop right now.
It's
not quite how it happened. I was a huge admirer of Andy's work, and there were photo essays being published. But the first time we met, I actually made the trek to the Daily, and I met you there. I didn't invite you to my apartment to just come over out of the blue.
I didn't remember that part.
I was asking you out for a date or something.
No.
I went to the paper, and I was like, "Whoa, Andy, I'm Daryl." Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, it's funny. It's actually very funny how 45 years have passed, and we each have very different, but the same thing that happened, and I'm certain it happened, and he's certain it happened, and we were both there, but we have very different perspectives on it and how it changed.
I defer to Andy most of the time. His record has better memory than me, but so I remember.
I don't remember that first part about the newspaper, but I remember going to see him at his apartment, wherever it was, and then that was when he proposed that we're going to do this. I have this connection at Pine Knob. I want us to be the house photographers. What I was impressed with, he already was working with, he knew Chick Corea and Stanley Clark, had been traveling with him and been doing stuff. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. So it was like a real adult job. And also I had no business sense at all at that point. I'm working for a student-run newspaper. There were no adults there. And so like, I was just really impressed with Daryl's entrepreneurial skills. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, I'll just be taking the pictures. And you can, you know, you're dealing and you got the in. That sounds great. Let's go. And that was how I saw it started.
So, yeah. Daryl, talk about how, you know, this kind of, it sounds like the vision that you had to basically take over the universe there at Pine Knob.
I wish I could tell you the seed of what the inspiration was. There was a high school buddy of mine, Lou Raisin, who's gone on to become the major Broadway theatrical player in Chicago. He actually was sent by the Nederlanders to open Poplar Creek when Poplar Creek opened, and he ran that for a while. But we were buddies, and he reported to Wayne Nederlander, and I realized that I enjoyed theatrical photography. There was a challenge to it. The notion of being able to capture someone at a peak moment in action. This is before autofocus cameras. And to be able to like anticipate the way people would move and the way the lights and the mic stands could be interesting obstacles that could be used as compositional elements. And there was a guy whose work I became aware of, Giuseppe Pino, who kind of revolutionized theatrical photography. And Andy and I were really lucky because we ended up getting his job at the Montreux Jazz Festival, which was a few years later. But I idolized him. And Andy was like a really seriously great photographer. And I'd pick up the Michigan Daily and I was going, whoa. And I thought, and he turned out to be a really nice guy. And I thought, we just need to do something together. And that was the vision that I had. And really interestingly, a number of people signed on to like both of us showing up and doing a gig, whether it was at Pine Knob or like say Time Magazine. Like they liked the coverage that the two of us would provide together. And we had different assets. And as I've said before, Andy was consistently a better photographer than me. Every now and then I got something where I beat him. But that was the exception, you know, yeah. Not the rule. And but we worked really well together, and it was a good and that was it. We had fun, and we were able to open up doors and in a big way, and we're able to create careers for ourselves.
Sure. And you know, you guys, the timing of it, you were part of the beginning, certainly, of rock concert photography. That was there had been photographers taking pictures at rock concerts, but the actual art of rock concert photography was so young. How did you kind of approach shooting these shows, and what to you made a good concert photograph?
Andy, go.
Well, yeah, that is kind of interesting. So at that time, I was doing other photography as well, but there were real challenges. First off, you have lighting. You're not in control of the lighting. You got microphones in the way. So the trick was to kind of isolate the performer, find your right angle. And that was what was so good about Pine Knobs, that we had full run of the place. And so you could move around the stage from one end to the other. And in fact, we were able to go backstage. I mean, I have this great shot of Bob Seger where you see the whole crowd behind him that got used in a rock and roll book. Also, we could go, I noticed it's a Greg Allman picture that's also used on the Pine Knob site. And I was up on the catwalk. And so you're looking down at the piano, you see the keys, and then you also see the set list. You know, you got like Stage Bar Blues, One Way Out. And so that was the challenge. So trying to find that moment, and Daryl was also talking about getting that moment when somebody is, you know, doesn't have their eyes closed the wrong way, or you know, is in that when they're hitting the note, you sort of have to anticipate as the music is happening, but you've got to be in that position. And you also, it's somewhat physical. You have to hold the camera really steady. That was the back in the days when you never also never knew what you had. Now you look at the screen. Oh, right. I got to move right on. Right. And then everybody also has a great camera now on their phone. But then you actually, there was a high bar to photography. You also had to then develop the film, make prints. And we were doing that. We did that at Pine Knob and then at Montreux as well, where we would shoot the show, stay up all night. One of us would process the film. The other one gets up the next morning, is starting to make prints. And we would, because Pine Knob was, that was the height of the kind of summer concert tour where they would come in for multiple nights. And so you could go back the second night and show them pictures. And right, that was part of the business plan that Daryl had. So we're going to sell the pictures to these guys. And we had some success with that, right? And
it made some big money.
You know, it was exciting. I got to meet Joni Mitchell backstage and showed her. We had this picture of Michael Brecker that I had taken earlier. And she was all like, that is fantastic. You know, for me to have Joni Mitchell, you know, saying that was one of the highlights of my Pine Knob days.
But I was joking when I said we're making big money. We were selling the prints for $5 and $10.
Well, that was more than $5 and $10 means now. So
yeah. True. And for us, it was really about opening doors. And Andy and I were chatting a few days ago about this. The one thing, as he mentioned, many artists were there for multiple nights. And there was a big one for us. It was a Crosby, Stills, and Nash thing that opened up so many doors for me later, where I became a tour photographer for them. But we shot them the first night, made some prints. They were having a big dinner at a hotel. And I was told by one of the road managers, his name was Armando Hurley, come to this hotel, bring what you got, and we'll see. And like, we weren't allowed to get in, and we were waiting outside and like this lobby outside one of the banquet rooms where they're having this big dinner. And like, we're waiting and waiting and waiting with our prints, and we thought nothing was going to happen. Then finally, one of the guys came out and started looking at the pictures. They went in and got the other guys. They come out. And then the next day we took more photos than Andy's liaising with them backstage at Pine Up. And it just literally created a relationship out of the notion of being diligent and creating good work and getting in front of these guys as soon as we could.
You know, it's interesting because concert photography now has become, as you're aware, very regimented. You know, the big laugh is first three, no flash, you know, and
that, that's terrible.
That started very soon after it was in the early 80s. Who started? It was I remember those, because I was doing that then. And that was like, you know what? I'm done with this. And that was sort of the end of my.
I remember that.
Because it's like, you're not going to get anything, and you're fighting. They were cornering us in. So that's why Pine
Knob is
such a great place for it. I can't remember. I've lost that. It was already, so you're talking about 40 years ago. Somebody said,
it started.
I don't want to be, I'm getting all sweaty. I don't want to do that.
And my whole thing is actually the opposite. I became a manager of artists, including some of the artists that I had photographed in the 80s. And as a former photographer, I always want folks to get great shots. And the venues get upset with me when I say the photographer has full run of the place, as long as he or she wears black and doesn't interfere with the patrons' experience of the evening, they can shoot the entire show, because it'll just mean better photos of my artist. So this three songs and you're done thing is terrible. Anyway,
without a doubt. What did it say at that time, though, about the relationship between the photographer and the performer? It almost sounds like it was more of a collaboration and a greater sense of trust in you as fellow artists.
Depends on who. The jazz guys, see, this is what I loved about that. Nobody was paying attention to jazz at that point. Rock and roll was big. Jazz was kind of on its way out, except in Europe. And they gave us all the time we wanted. That's where I was getting some of my best portraits. It's like, oh, you want to take some pictures? Sure, great. You know, you're paying attention. And so, I felt like, again, early on, I was seeing that there were barriers up. And a lot of it is because, you know, you got these fans who are crazy for them, and they've got to, you know, beat back the groupies and keep people away from us. And that actually was interesting about why I started to shoot the crowds. And that also was that opportunity at Pine Knot. I saw that immediately. I had other aspirations with photography, not just doing the concerts. That was one part of it, but I wanted to do like an art project. And immediately the first couple of days I'm there, I'm noticing each crowd was different. There's, you know, the Chicago crowd is going to be different than the Liberace crowd who comes in, and different than the Marshall Tucker crowd. And you've got people who are drinking, the crowds where there's a lot of alcohol, it's a little rowdier. And then you got Neil Young, where people are smoking pot and everybody's laid back and it's much different. And then you got the cocktail crowd with Frank Sinatra and those guys. And so I thought, this is really a cross section. I mean, of course, it's suburban Detroit, but it is a cross section of middle America, what we look like now. And you look back at those pictures, and it's really kind of has this historic record of what was going on.
It is.
I had this, you know, I'm 20 years old, and I think I'm going to be, you know, Diane Arbus. I'm going to be and you know, I was a little bit ahead of myself there. But then we moved on. We went to Montreux, and then I left school and went to New York, and those pictures just sat in a file for years and years. And then I started to bring them out and realized, like, an editor friend of mine was looking at them and said, oh my God, look at these. And I started to compile it. And then I showed it to another editor. I said, you know, I wish you just had a little bit more. This could be a book if it was a little bit more. So just, you know, I wish I could go back and just have shot every single show and done that. But it's still a nice grouping of photos. So that, in terms of that, like you're saying about collaboration, I think with some it was, with others we were just kind of those annoying guys on the side.
more the latter.
What were some of
the other good anecdotes and adventures about, you know, specific artists and your encounters with them through the lens?
You want me to do
go ahead.
On the negative end, again, there was Chuck Mangione, who knows what he was on then, but we had shot the night before. I had a good picture of his bass player. I don't remember who he was or what. And we brought him back, you know, shot it, printed it, $10 for the guy. And the guy's like, $10? And he goes, Chuck, what do you think? These guys, you know, they want to sell me this picture for $10. And he comes out furious, screaming, hustlers, they're hustlers. What are they trying to do? And I was like, oh my God, he's screaming. We had done this really nice shot of this guy. And then, like, you know, that was really like, you got to be kidding me. And Daryl and I, at that time, we took it very personally too. So we were not happy.
Two sensitive guys. I didn't even remember that story. Andy reminded me of it. But there's another story that's similar. Chuck Mangione was working at the Montreux Jazz Festival, and Claude Nobbs was the producer of the festival, and Claude tried to cut his set short because it's a long night. Chuck wouldn't have it. He's still playing. Claude comes on there. They shut off the sound. Chuck goes off the stage. He's chasing Claude Nobbs around the venue. I'll never forget that. So he was a bona fide nut, but I needed the perspective of a few years later, you know, after the Pine Knob experience. But for me, the one thing that I was discussing with Andy and I mentioned to you, my favorite story, I mean, there are a lot of cute little anecdotes and fun things, especially the rock and roll shows and the sex backstage. And I mean, all of the craziness, but there was an important moment for me, an inflection point where Harry Chapin, of all people, I didn't think I was going to like him, especially, kind of a little bit corny kind of guy. Unbelievably great show. He really knew how to, to leave it all out on the stage. And I'm backstage now taking some photos. And I heard him mention to someone that he was going to perform the next night and wasn't doing much the next day. And so I took it upon myself to ask him when people weren't paying attention to him and talking to others, hey, I would like to take some portraits of you tomorrow. And he says very, very loudly, conspicuously. So it's like, I'm incredibly busy and don't have time. I'm not going to be able to do that. And but thank you, though. And maybe another time. And I was simmering because I just heard him tell someone else how he didn't have much going on. And it was a bit painful. And I thought, okay, I need to do this. And I I found another moment to approach him. And I said, hey, I heard you say to someone else how open your schedule is tomorrow. I said, have you already forgotten what it was like when you were getting started? And he looked at me and said, show up at this hotel at 10:30 in the morning. And that was it. And a really great friendship started from that. So he was just a great guy. So that's my favorite story.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it, stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Yeah. I would just think that some of these, they're, on the flip side, they're getting hit from all sides. And
that's true.
Like crazy fans who are trying to get at them, and the I guess the default thing was to kind of put the bar up. No, stay away. And who are these guys being really pushy? And, that
we were.
That was I got one more funny story about just from the crowd that I remember that always kind of pops up with Neil Diamond was playing. And he liked to interact a little bit with the audience. And the fans at Pine Knob were just crazy for him. He was there for a couple of nights, and it was right at the height of his, Sweet Caroline period. And so he would like to interact with the audience, and he had these women kind of came up to the stage, and he's like, oh, hi, darling, what's your name? And she goes, my husband's a urologist. And all just cracks up. Like, he's like, oh, I was asking your name. Just the idea that she got nervous. And she identifies that her husband's a urine doctor. But anyway, that was one of my favorites.
I have a sexy one. Bette Midler. She was during a curtain, unbelievably great, great. There's some performers that are just so great. And every night they're a little bit different. And there's some that need to do things exactly the same way from night to night. And Neil Diamond having been one of those. But so Bette Midler, great show. She comes out for a curtain call. She comes out for a second bow, this time in a towel. And people are already leaving. And I've got a camera in my hand. I'm right at the edge of the proscenium. She drops the towel. She's naked. People are screaming. And I'm transfixed. Now, if Andy was by me at that time, Andy would have gotten the photo.
I wasn't at that show.
Yeah. But for me, I was like, holding onto the camera, my eyes wide open, like, oh my goodness. And she looked at me like, don't you dare take a photo. And she quickly picked up the towel, put it back on, goes off the stage. All right. 30 years later, I'm at a dinner We're seated opposite from one another at the table. And I mentioned to her that we, you know, exchanged pleasantries. And I said, well, we kind of met before about 30 years ago. And her response was, I don't want to hear it. And I said, but it's a nice story. She goes, I don't want to hear it, Darryl. And she just shut me down. It was clear that from that period of her life, gosh knows how many times she dropped how many towels or whatever it was that she did. She just didn't want to be reminded of anything of that stage of her life, which was a really smart way of navigating it. But anyway.
I think you're right. Was there anything about Pine Knob as a venue that distinguished it as a place to shoot from other venues that you worked at?
Andy?
Well, I kind of went into how cool it was to be able to go up on the lawn and kind of interact with the crowd. I mean, I love that. And also that, and also because of the, in Michigan, the light is late in the summer, it stays light late. And so there was just this beautiful light. So for me, that was just fantastic to be able to shoot the crowd in this beautiful light, which is, that was one thing. And then in terms of the venue itself, I mean, because we had this free run, we had the same thing at Montreux, but it was much more compressed.
Yeah, the sight lines weren't as great.
And the fact that we go around and then that we could, you know, we had the full run of the stage and, you know, they made it really nice for us there that we were there for those 2 years. I mean, they were, and we got to know everybody who worked there because we were just interacting with them. I just thought that was really, it was just a great time. I enjoyed my time there.
The sight lines at Pine Knob were fantastic. There's not another place that that rivaled that for me as a photographer in different venues. There are just so many different perspectives and different ways that you can get in different nooks and crannies and have fun and get really great, interesting angles.
Right.
That just made it more challenging and more satisfying.
I was just saying about the microphones in that day. And now it is a little bit easier. You can kind of erase stuff very easily. So the microphone coming out of somebody's head can disappear. But there you were able to, because you could get those different angles, you could get the microphone out of the way. These things that were sort of sticking. It always bothered me to have some microphone sticking out of somebody's head. So that I don't know how they allow photographers to do that now. But in that day, I mean, we were really lucky. There were very few people doing that. So.
But there were some tour photographers for some of the bands, and that's when I would get really supercharged and super competitive. I mean, some like really famous photographers would be coming in, and I'd say, Andy, we can beat them. Come on, come on, let's go. And we would go for it, and we got our work on a number of albums that we shot at Pine Knob, which they still paid us $5 or $10 or whatever. And the excuse was because we had so-and-so as the tour photographer that we were paying every day to be with us. But we got a lot of work in there and it helped build our portfolios.
Yeah. Which was great. So many of the artists you mentioned shooting are still with us and still performing. Did you have a sense at the time that you were looking, that you were working with and photographing potentially generational artists, like, you know, the jazz artists, some of them you worked with, you know, these, even by the time you got to them, they were in their third decade maybe or more, but were you getting a sense that there was the potential for the kind of lifetime that these artists have had?
Andy?
But I have to say, because I was 20 years old and 21, I didn't have that perspective. I wish I did. I don't know if it would have changed things. But it is true. I mean, you look at like Joni Mitchell, for instance. I just got a call last week that they're doing, Rhino Records is doing a 1975 to 1980, her music from there. And they saw a picture that I had put on Instagram, the one of her playing with Pat Metheny, Jaco Pastorius. It was her, but you see Pat Metheny in the background. I mean, that was an incredible band, Michael Brecker. I knew that that was an incredible band, that she had put this, you know, these great jazz guys together with her. And they ended up not picking that picture. I happened to have photographed her in Washington during the No Nukes concert. And she was backstage and Graham Nash is with her. There's a picture of her. She's got a cigarette. I wonder if she's going to allow that one to be in. And then also her playing guitar there. But I kind of knew that that might have been a moment in history. You're sort of around these people. But, you know, at that time, I didn't have that life experience yet to realize, oh, this is really historic. I just knew there was a certain point when we got to Montreux by after the third year. It's like, and I was a big fan of music and I was just burned out. I had heard all of my favorite musicians and I had met them. And it's like, and then it's like, all right, how many more pictures like this can I take? I kind of got burned out because it just became a routine. And then also that they were kind of narrowing the, you know, they weren't going to allow you to shoot the whole show, or they were narrowing the constraints of what you could do. So go ahead, Daryl, you got some ideas on this?
No, I'm a couple years older than Andy. I'm embarrassed to admit, I didn't have a self-awareness of what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing. All I knew was that photography for me was a passport to have access to something to which I was otherwise prevented. That's all ever was. And Andy was way more fastidious than I was with negatives and slides to protect them and have them, send them to photo agencies, make money on them, get them republished. For me, I would just give them away because it was less about that for me than it was about just being able to be there and experience the moment and wait until the next moment. So I was completely unconscious.
That's great. Well, listen, Andy Freeberg and Daryl Pitt, this has been a wonderful conversation. The quick allusion to backstage sex did not escape us, but it's probably not where we should go. I want to thank both of you very much for being part of Hello Pine Knob. And this is Gary Graff, your host, signing off. We will see you at the next episode. And in the meantime, we'll see you out on the lawn.
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.